I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. James Meskelic joins me again. The celebrated humanitarian doctor and author has just published a new memoir, Life on the Ground Floor, Letters from the Edge of Emergency Medicine. The notices have been already very good, just as they were for his previous book, 6 Months in Sudan, which he was on this program with when it was published in 2009. This new book is a personal book for Dr. Meskelic. In it, he discusses his experience in emergency rooms across the world, cultures, resources, medical challenges may differ hospital to hospital, but care remains the same. James takes us from Canada to Ethiopia and elsewhere. It's a compelling book about connecting, about life and death, and about the people around us. I'll get Dr. Meskelic to tell us about this book, about the wisdom he's gained over the years, and that which he shares in this book. James Meskelic is an emergency room physician who divides his time between Toronto and Addis Ababa. He is a member of Médecins Sans Frontières and a meditation teacher with the Conscious Explorers Club. The website for more is at jamesmeskelic.com. The book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program while here in Vancouver last week, James Meskelic. Dr. Meskelic, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Where were you born?
I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, in the Misericordia Hospital. And lived just outside of Edmonton for most of my life.
Yeah, and so how? I guess the other question I have is, how did you end up in Toronto?
You know, when you graduate from medical school and you want to do a particular type of medicine, in my case, emergency medicine, you have to be willing to go wherever you're able to do the training. Sometimes you get to choose where that is, and other times you don't. So back in the old days, you got a letter in your mailbox that said, congratulations, you're going to be a psychiatrist in Newfoundland. And your friend is going to be an orthopedic surgeon in Vancouver. And you leave and you start your training. So for me, I wanted to stay in Alberta. There was one emergency position. My friend Sarah got it. Uh-huh. And I transferred to Toronto. And the rest is history.
Yeah, there's a in the book, there's a connection to Alberta, obviously. I mean, you talk about your grandfather. Does the rest of your family still live there?
They do, and you know, as no matter where I travel, you know, and I think this book, like my first one, really reflected a lot on what home is. And no matter where I travel, somehow Alberta will always be that place for me. It just feels like my natural resting place. So, though I certainly have traveled the world, that's always like coming home.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about your visit back to Alberta. Your visits, I should say, back to Alberta that you write about in the book in just a sec. But what struck me in reading your book, because I'm reminded of the first book, is just how beautifully written it is. So I'm wondering, as you're carrying on with your job and your adventures throughout the world, do you keep a diary or journal?
You know, I very much did that in Sudan, and it was, you know, a way for me to reclaim a little bit of space, because I didn't feel like I had very much there, being such a close proximity to that conflict. And now I it was less easy for me to recollect, because I fell out of the habit. My life just kind of got in the way. So a lot of the scenes that I conjure in this book, Life on the Ground Floor, are from my memory. And I can temporally place it, but a lot of the scenes that I evoke are something that I had to draw from my memory. So it took me a little bit of a different process in my first time around with 6 months in Sudan.
And so in your daily life, though, I mean, even as a kid, did you keep notes and the sort of like a diary?
I did over time, you know, yeah. not religiously like some people did, but certainly when I traveled, and certainly when I felt that sense of clarity, I suppose, that is so rare in a writer's life, where something clicks, a metaphor makes sense, and you're drawn to capture that. So I have these snippets of sentences and scenes and words that I keep, you know, in a folder in my email, and I write when I have a few minutes. And so from it comes these kernels of ideas, and those things ended up forming a lot of what I put into this latest book.
Now, your work as an emergency doctor has taken you throughout the world. One of the things that I've always wondered about people in your trade is does that work, being there in the emergency room, does that make you understand death a little bit better, say?
Well, I don't think you can understand something without actually having experienced it, really. So I can't say that I have an understanding of it. I have an appreciation for the dying process and an appreciation for what it's like to watch people go through it, not just the individual who's dying, but the family that's surrounding that loved one. So it does lead me to reflect on it quite a lot. And as you know, from having read my book, it kind of builds up to that, you know, final reflection on what might that mean? What might that look like? What might that be like for me? And because it's this unenunciated elephant in the room a lot of the time, we're not very good at talking about that process. I think it's more common for people to say, I've been to four weddings, but I have in the last little while. I've watched this many people get married, but I certainly have not seen that many people die.
Yeah.
And why not? We're afraid of it. It's the unknown, and it's what we don't know is what we fear, and we can't know it. But I meditate on it. I think about it. I realize that no matter how much energy I devote towards it, I'll never get closer to the answer. But what does come up is if I don't know yet what it's like to die, then the question comes, well, maybe I can know what it's like to be fully alive.
Yeah.
And that's what I see. That's what stirs in me when I see someone in the ER who is sick too soon or injured too soon, is it makes me want to call my family and remind them how much I love them. It makes me want to look people in the eye who ask me for money. It makes me want to fully show up in all the ways that matter to my patients, in my relationship, in my phone conversations with people like yourself, and because it matters. This is, we have one life. Maybe we have more, I can't say. I don't know. Yeah. But I know we have one, and what we do, how we spend our time really matters. And, I don't have an understanding of death. I think I'm starting to get a hint of what it is to be alive.
I guess the reason why we're not good at talking about death is we're either afraid of growing old, or we're afraid of the pain that usually comes with death.
Yes.
I mean, have you found it in your job as a doctor that you have the skills, not only in terms of dealing with sadness or grief, but knowing what to say to people who are ill or who are suffering from even not even pain, but just grief itself?
Yes, you know, and it's probably the part of the practice that I find most, not satisfying is the wrong word, into which I can continue to grow infinitely, mm-hmm. I suppose, is the right way to think about it. And what, so maybe it'll change even more as I get more seasoned in my clinical practice, but I just say, you know, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I know this is hard for you, and I wish I could take it away, but I can't. And so let's talk about what you need most now. And then I listen, and I'm just there with that person. And sometimes they have a clear idea, and sometimes they're afraid, or sometimes they're in denial, and they don't know what to do. But it's in those moments where I feel deeply connected to people, even if they're a stranger. And I think it's what they want of me as a doctor. And from that is a very naturally healing place, a healing space that comes from real honesty and real emotional integrity. And, you know, from that space is where all of the ERs come from, and all the hospitals, all the pharmaceutical companies. And you know, unfortunately, that space can be corrupted somewhat. Profit can make you make different decisions sometimes, or some bias that you're not even quite sure about. Yeah. But at its very most pure and most natural, it's a communion of two people, or more than to people if you work in a team like I do in the ER, mm-hmm. with a shared goal of alleviating someone's suffering and meeting their fear.
Well, what's the I mean, we have a sense of what the physical toll is, but the emotional toll is something that you sort of capture in the book, and if you look closely, you do see it there. Do you think you're stronger for the work that you do?
Definitely so. And I mean stronger by more prone to crying. Yes, stronger that way, sure. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll do that. More willing to admit when I don't know the answer. Stronger that way, yes. And you know, I think that there's a mistake sometimes in thinking that maybe the portrayal of strength is being somewhat stoic or unmoved, but that's not how I have changed.
Uh-huh.
But what's happened is I've softened in all the right ways. And I know more than ever before how much it matters that I'm sad when someone is next to me in grief, that it's okay. And so it has been this almost like solvent for some of the most calcified parts of me.
Yeah, for a lot of people in your line of work, though, they're not able to get to where you are at the end of your day. I mean, a lot of them turn to drink or drugs and the sort.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you tell those people in terms of how they might deal with whatever they're taking home with them better?
You know, I am those people. You know, I'm not, it's easy for me to say sitting in the Vancouver sunshine about how important it is to stay connected to your patients. But, you know, after I've worked a lot of shifts in a row at the end of a day, you know, I'm not always able to have that sense of equanimity follow me around, although I know it's my main practice, and I really do try it.
Mm.
For all those people who are in the same line of work that I am, and it doesn't have to just be ER work, it can be anything that puts you into contact with grief and direct contact with suffering, or pain, people in pain. You know, I think that what I hope comes up and what's coming up more strongly for me in the last few years is how important it is that I take care of myself, that it's okay to take time away to reflect and to grow and to see what I need. But, you know, to put up an emotional wall or to use alcohol to do the same or to use drugs to do the same is preventing the process from fully completing itself, because it has in it the self-extinguishing nature where you are, as you're present for someone who is, say, in grief or have compassion for someone who is in pain, and you meet to move to address that pain, that has a self-extinguishing nature, meaning that it doesn't linger. It's not something you bottle away like it would if you put up a wall or went home and had three drinks because you got in a fight with a colleague at work and you put off that work for a little bit later, because it never really goes away. It just builds up until you break down. So what happens now, you know, I had a not a generous encounter with a doctor in training maybe a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't treat me very well, and I didn't appreciate it. And so when I next, I was brusque with them on the phone. And when I next saw them, I apologized. Even though I didn't really think I needed to. I was their senior, and I think that I was right. But I said, that wasn't the right way for us to have a talk about how we both could have done better.
Mm.
We both could have done better. So I'll endeavor in our future encounters to do better on my part. Now, what can you do? What do you think you can do better? You know, I didn't let that, I didn't go home mad and take it out on some other person in my life. So I think that the more we can talk about how to stay well in the face of these constant demands on us emotionally and spiritually, the better we're able to do the medicine, and the better it's able to work on us too.
How did your colleague take to your apology?
I think that she was, you know, medicine can be slightly hierarchical. Not slightly. It can be very hierarchical. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever been a patient with a doctor, but
right.
It can be as a hierarchy there. But that exists within medicine too. So I think that she was probably a bit intimidated by my pulling her aside a second time. But what she will discover is I intend to follow through with that.
Yeah.
When I encounter her again, she'll see what I mean. And that really matters. It doesn't matter what you say. It does not matter what you say. It doesn't matter. It matters what you do. And so my intention is to continue to follow through with what I declared to her, which is to be more generous in the way we relate, in the way I relate.
So you've been an emergency doctor for a while now, and I'm assuming, because you've been a doctor for a while, that you can go into any other kind of practice or any other kind of city or job that you'd like. Why have you remained in emergency medicine?
Well, emergency is, it's not that easy for me to transition out of it. I was trained as an emergency specialist, so I did a 5-year training program like, a surgeon would or whatever, to do emergency. And I do long for something that maybe has a little bit more regular hours, but I do wish that I had more time to spend with particular people,
mm-hmm.
because if someone comes in and they say they're 20 and they want to kill themselves, I want more than 5 minutes with that person. I want like 25 minutes with that person.
Yeah.
So I think that, well, I don't want to leave emergency because I'm good at it. It's the body of knowledge that I have. It's what I teach. It's what I know. I look to be better at it. I am going to work on expanding my career to include something that allows me a little bit more of an opportunity to get to know people, which is something that I miss.
And do you think in writing, as you have, this book and the previous one, you obviously get to know people. People get to know you better because they read your books, but do you think you get to know yourself better?
Yeah, I do. And having conversations like we're having now and reflecting more on what I'd hope to accomplish with the book, because when you're in the middle of it, it's this big, huge event that only you're experiencing, because it starts from nothing and becomes something. And then you release it into the world, and then people say, why? And then you have to own that. Why? I think that for me, you know, as a boy, I was a writer. And I was a writer before I became a doctor. And it was a way to untangle my experience. And now when I write, like I did this book about what I consider to be the true intention of medicine, or the deeper principle underlying it, it's untangling that almost ephemeral and impossible to describe language of the human heart and hopes and what makes a good life. And at that, you can only ever throw words at. You can, you know, if you could just get it right, then everyone would say, oh, that's it. Perfect. We're all, you know, but, So to take aim at something like how love for our family and the sadness that I feel when I go to a place like Ethiopia and I see my friends struggling so hard with so much less than what I have, and I come back in a plane and I don't know how to talk about it very well. That's a really great blessing for me.
The relationship with your family, your grandfather especially, is borne out in this book. When you write about him and you write about the experience of growing up and you write about growing older, as he did and as you are, I mean, there's some wisdom there, and I'm trying not to give anything away, but I'm also wanting to get at the heart of what you might have discovered about yourself through him.
Yeah, I'm so blessed to have him as a figure in my life. And I don't just mean that he's a rare person. He is a rare person.
Yeah.
Not many people like him, even 100 years ago when he was born, more or less. He's 94. Not many people like him. Even then, he was a man of the wilderness, really. You know, he would go to trap line for 3 months by himself and no power and be alone. And he knows how to live very simply and is that great wisdom. You know, I think that we're as wise as the oldest person alive because only they can tell us what it's like to have lived that long. So when I watch him and I watch his body fall away, and I know my mind will do the same, around that is this pure spirit that has always been there since he was a kid. It's so clear. And he has so little fear about dying. He understands that circle very well. And so to have reflected back to me something that, by someone so wise, but it's natural. It's not easy, but there's nothing to fear. Then that's not only do I have a grandfather, I have a teacher.
Yeah.
So it's I love him very much.
Yeah. What do you think people need to know about? I guess people around, like, you know, we know how we are in our own little sphere, if you will, our own little neighborhood or city. But I mean, you go, you know, halfway around the world for a good part of your year as well. I mean, what do you think we need to know about the other person? And I think this builds into the whole idea of the book about connecting with people, because you spend what? How much of your time do you spend in Ethiopia?
I mean, I probably do 6 months every couple years.
Yeah.
It works out to be the time that I'm away, or 6 months every 3 years, depending. You know, mentally and daily, I work on Ethiopia. From there, from here.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer it when I'm in the country, but it's like it is with this book. It's a full-time job.
Yeah.
You know, what does that mean in terms of connection with people far away? You know what? Before we leave my grandfather, I just wanted to mention one thing about it, and that's just that, you know, the care that you offer the elderly, the aged people, like I will be one day, like you will be one day. It matters so much to them that they're not considered irrelevant, because they're still very much that same person they were when they were a little boy.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I look at our society, I can see how we shuffle people who are elderly in a way, we move them out of the way somehow. And I'm so grateful to have my parents who teach me, who are taking care of my grandfather, who teach me. And I'm my pleasure and privilege to do the same for them. I promise that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are the similarities between here and places really far away? I bristle when people talk about the first world and the third world. There's one world. And why things look very differently in Ethiopia than they do in the emergency department in Toronto is for knowable reasons. And it's, can I say, it's not illegal, so I can't say it's a crime.
Yeah.
But it sure is a shame. It sure is a shame. So we can do better than we're doing, and we choose not to. You know, what are the reasons why? Well, the only thing that I've been able to really put my finger on, and I'm really happily to be disabused of this notion, is a lingering systemic racism that makes it seem like these problems aren't as valid. That's really it. You know, then there's the failures of us to imagine fully places that are far away in a way that leads us to emotionally engage with them. I understand that. That's a human trait.
Mm-hmm.
But the systematic, continued attrition of human resources and actual resources from places that need them in order to serve people who already have more than enough is a shame. You know, the book talks about life on the ground floor, because I'll tell you what, the principles are exactly the same if you're Ethiopian as they are a Canadian. I teach the exact same medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I just, our ability to respond to it is very different, as you know.
So how do you think it gets better?
By admitting complicity, by really being honest about what the intention, what our deepest intention is. You know, if it isn't to ameliorate, unnecessary suffering for people far away, then be honest about it. That's fine. But don't pretend it's one thing and then do another thing. That's standing in the way. That's really standing in the way. And I would argue that it is on the road to solving something as literal as emergency access to vulnerable people in Ethiopia, on the road to something that we will address problems, larger problems that we have yet to even tackle. So I think that the work towards an easier and better world is very much within our grasp. And that's what's so frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's so hard to take. We already know everything that we need to know. And so the reason why, I guess, it seems to me to be taking such an achingly long time is that watching people suffer and die unnecessarily happens in my life a lot. Witnessing. So I won it yesterday. And what I really would love to get across this message is that, you know, people, we face this at the same time as we have this capacity to do really well with what we have and actualize our own lives and get rid of all the extra stuff we don't need. And so we can focus on the things that really, truly matter in our lives, how to find love, how to be a good partner or friend, you know. There's this, we at the same time as we have that capacity, we're facing this nihilism that it's too late.
Yeah.
But the human experiment's a failed one. The coral reefs are bleaching. It's, let's just smoke them while we got them. What we don't need is more people hanging back in the pocket and waiting. We don't need that. Yeah. Now's not the time to do that. If you ever, you know, I'm a terrible surfer, but I'm not a bad snowboarder. If you've ever done anything like that, you know when you get to the edge, that the farther you get to the on one edge, it means you have to start turning back. And now's that time. You can surf it. You know, you can feel that now we need to start pulling back. We need people to deeply engage with the biggest problems of our time. Yes, climate change. Certainly poverty. Certainly poverty. And not just because poor people are it's a shame, but because if you work to emancipate people from the vagaries of subsistence living, and you work to create opportunities for women who've been held back for too long to reach their full potential and be fully, you know, actualized in their lives, however they choose to do it, then you will have more people engaged in finding solutions to these very problems. And I bet you that they're going to come from places like India and Ethiopia.
Yeah.
And places who have a high population density. It's hard to believe that Canada is going to be able to write the answer, but I bet you if we listen carefully and we work hard to address these difficult problems, we will see that we'll have even more to show for it.
James, this is such a beautiful book, and it's been such a pleasure to talk to you about it. Congratulations on it. I hope it continues to do well for you, because it's a book that people need to read.
Thanks, man.
The book is called Life on the Ground Floor, Letters from the Edge of Emergency Medicine. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Dr. James Maskalik, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunter.